and welcome to Show Me Your Care Plan, Insights for Oncology Nurses, Integrating Recent Developments to Improve Outcomes for Patients with Platinum-Resistant Ovarian Cancer. I'm Kelsey, and I'm an Associate for Educational Strategy with PER. Now for our faculty, we have today our Chair of the Program, Ritu Salani. I'm going to hand it over to her to introduce the other faculty, and yeah.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here with us. My name is Ritu Salani. I'm joining you from California. I'm at UCLA, where I'm a gynecologic oncologist, and I'm thrilled to be here. And I'm really excited to be joined by two wonderful colleagues who I'm going to allow to introduce themselves. We're going to go by first names, so I'm going to let Emily introduce herself first.
Hi, everybody. Good afternoon. I'm Emily Alfaro. I am the clinical nurse specialist at UCSF Health for infusion services with a specialty in solid tumor for the last 17-plus years. I'm happy to be here, and I'll pass it over to Jill.
Hi there. I'm Jill Aldridge. I'm a G1 oncologist here at the University of Colorado in Denver. I've been in practice for 6 years, and I'm excited to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
And I guarantee you're going to get good education because I gave Jill her boards a few years ago, and
this
she is outstanding. But it's truly my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jill Aldridge, who's going to speak to us about current challenges in the management of platinum-resistant ovarian cancer.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. So my part of our program today is really going to be talking about where we've been and where we currently are in the space of platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, and to set that stage then for Dr. Salani to take us through sort of the future of how this may continue to develop in the coming years. So when a woman is first diagnosed with ovarian cancer, where surgery fits into the puzzle of their therapy really depends on some patient factors as well as distribution of disease. And surgery can either be an upfront paradigm followed by 6 rounds of chemotherapy, or we can kind of sandwich it in there, 3 cycles of chemotherapy, and if they have a good response, interval surgery and some additional chemotherapy. And just to go over the traditional regimens that we're using in this space are carboplatin and paclitaxel, or in women who have suboptimal surgery or who have stage 4 disease, combination of carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab. Following that frontline therapy, there are a lot of different strategies for how we provide maintenance therapy for these patients. A lot of this is driven by molecular testing, specifically using germline and somatic BRCA and HRD testing to guide our decisions on how we're going to roll out maintenance therapy for these patients. So in women who received bevacizumab with their upfront chemotherapy, we often will continue that on as a maintenance strategy. In women who are homologous recombination proficient, we continue that bevacizumab by itself. And then in women who have a BRCA germline or somatic mutation or who have homologous recombination deficiency, we combine that bevacizumab with a PARP inhibitor. In patients who did not get bevacizumab with their upfront chemotherapy, we triage them out again using their HRD status. So women with BRCA mutations or homologous recombination deficiency often get a PARP inhibitor therapy in this setting, given substantial benefits in outcome. And then women with homologous recombination proficiency, I would say there's a very mixed practice nationally where some are providing PARP inhibitor therapy in this setting and many are just observing alone. Unfortunately, despite an enormous amount of work in this space over the last decade, many women with ovarian cancer recur. So let's just take a moment to look at the timeline of when recurrence happens, because what we know is the timing of when a recurrence happens tells us about the sensitivity to platinum and whether reusing that agent makes sense. And that also has a lot of prognostic implication. So patients who have a progression of their cancer while on their upfront chemotherapy or within a month of completing that therapy are termed platinum refractory, and that portends a very poor prognosis. Those are no longer curative situations. It's a purely palliative approach as you continue to move ahead. In the platinum-resistant ovarian cancer space, that's going to be the label we assign if a recurrence happens within 6 months of the last dose of a platinum therapy. And while this is slightly more favorable than a platinum refractory situation, again, these women often have poor prognosis. Sorry about that. Oh, can't go back. Ah, yeah, we can. They often have a poor prognosis and limited therapeutic options as well. When we're in a space of greater than 6 months from the last line of platinum therapy, we can reutilize platinum-based doublets, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on that today. We're really going to focus in on these first two situations, platinum refractory and platinum resistant. In the platinum-resistant ovarian cancer space, we often use single-agent chemotherapies such as pegylated doxorubicin, gemcitabine, paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel, topotecan or pemetrexed. So we certainly have a number of agents in our arsenal here, but unfortunately, these often come with high toxicities and can come with an overall low response rate. We do know, based on a 2014, the Aurelia study, adding bevacizumab to any of the chemotherapies on that last page really does add something to their efficacy. We do have to keep in mind the added toxicity of bevacizumab. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about this agent today, but keeping in mind things like hypertension, risk of bowel perforation, risk of fistula, right? These agents don't come without their own risks. But in women who are good candidates for this, this can augment the progression-free survival and response rates when given alongside these other therapies. Outside of the cytotoxic chemotherapy realm, we can use targeted radiation in some situations of ovarian cancer. It's often not a tool we think of as having in our toolbox in the ovary cancer realm, but it is an option if given in sort of an oligometastatic, so one or two locations of recurrence, if they're in, I call it radiatable, I'm not sure that's a good adjective, but radiatable sites, you know, areas where they're going to have minimal toxicity to nearby organs, and then you're combining that with systemic therapy. In general, immunotherapies don't have much of a role in ovarian cancer all by themselves, but there are a few phase two trials out there where if we combine pembrolizumab as an immune checkpoint inhibitor with some additional therapies, we can have some more modest responses. So combining oral cyclophosphamide, pembrolizumab, and bevacizumab can be a good option, or combining pembrolizumab and niraparib can be a good option. In sort of a lower tier here, some additional salvage regimens we can think about are bevacizumab alone or anti-hormonal therapy. And it's really important in this space to walk that tightrope of toxicity to patients versus predicted outcomes. We have to really balance quality of life versus time of life in this equation and involve palliative care. In all of the regimens we just talked about, unfortunately, we're just not doing enough. And so that led to the development of some new additional therapies, and Dr. Solani is certainly going to talk about the emergence of many of these, but I want to spend some time talking to you about mirvetuximab. Mirvetuximab is within a new family of drugs called antibody-drug conjugates, and this is a clever mechanism where we're taking mirvetuximab, which is this folate receptor alpha targeted antibody. It's got a little linker that connects it to DM4, which is a taxane-like chemotherapy. And these are engineered chemo-Trojan horses, is the way that I think of these. We know that in the family of systemic chemotherapies, our aim is to kill all quickly dividing cells. And unfortunately, that means we have toxicity from the normal cells that are also getting hit by this therapy. So we have a much more narrow therapeutic window and higher toxicity. Antibody-drug conjugates, the aim is that we're delivering the chemotherapy to the cells that we're trying to target. Epithelial ovarian cancers have high folate receptor alpha expression many of the times, and so we're trying to deliver the chemo where we want it to go, and this allows for lower toxicity and a broader therapeutic window. The way that mirvetuximab and all antibody-drug conjugates are working is the antibody is binding the folate receptor alpha on the cell surface, and that cell is eating that therapy into it. And once it's inside of the cell, there's some activation that happens there, and that gets released, where that DM4 is now within the cell and can exert its action on the microtubules in a taxane-like action and result in apoptosis or cell death. There's also a bystander effect where that active therapy diffuses across to nearby cells that perhaps are folate receptor negative, so we're still getting some action on those. This mechanism led to the development of the initial phase 3 trial comparing mirvetuximab versus chemotherapy. This was called the Forward 1 trial. We were using a greater than 50% folate receptor alpha expression to define eligibility for this trial. And what we found is that we didn't see the effect we thought we would, right? We've got this really thoughtful, exciting mechanism, but it didn't come out like we thought it was going to. Our progression-free survival was very similar between our traditional standard of care chemotherapies and this exciting new agent. So when we really started to dive into that in a little bit more detail, we found that there's this subpopulation of folate receptor high expression tumors where they did have an advantage. So this led us to go back and rescore the patients who were on this study and look into, with a little finer tooth comb, who really benefited and who did not. And what we realized is we probably need to define our strata differently and redo this trial. So in a phase 3 single-arm trial called SORAYA, we looked at mirvetuximab in a group of patients who had folate receptor high expression, so greater than 75%. And in these patients, we had approximately a 30%. Ooh, I don't know how I'm doing that. I'm so sorry. Well, ignore the pointer. That's not intentional. Overall response rate of approximately 30%, which when we're thinking about those standard of care chemotherapies, we're typically talking in the 15 to 20% range, so this is certainly an improvement. We did note in these patients that we have some pretty unique toxicities. So this antibody-drug conjugate mechanism comes with some novel toxicities that we don't see in standard chemo, like blurry vision, keratopathy. We can still see some taxane-like toxicities, like neutropenia, diarrhea, or peripheral neuropathy. Given that promising result from the SORAYA trial, we sort of redid the Forward trial with these new criteria, again comparing standard of care chemotherapies against mirvetuximab in that high expression 75%+ subgroup population. There we go. And what we found, we have nice separation of these curves you can see on that top right graph, a 35% improvement in progression-free survival for these patients. We doubled their overall response rate, 42% versus 16%, compared to the standard of care chemotherapy arm, and a 33% improvement in overall survival. And just to give a little background, proving an overall survival benefit with therapies in ovarian cancer is a hard task in this complex disease. So this is really exciting data that's practice-changing. We do see in the chemotherapy arm sort of the toxicities you'd expect from cytotoxic chemotherapy. And you can see on the orange bars here that mirvetuximab does have some unique toxicities, like we saw in the SORAYA trial. So eye toxicities like blurred vision, keratopathy, diarrhea or nausea, peripheral neuropathy, and then rarely some hematologic toxicity. Overall, the population who's having high toxicity grade 3 or 4 adverse events are rare. All of this really exciting data led to the approval of mirvetuximab by the FDA in 2024, and this is now the standard of care in the platinum-resistant ovarian cancer space for women with 75%+ expression of folate receptor alpha. That still led us to the question of, can we do better? Right? Can we do more for that population who's in that 50 to 75% range who didn't have the same benefit? And in that subgroup, from 50% to 100%, we broke it into a 25 to 50, a 50 to 75, and a 75 to 100%, and added bevacizumab alongside mirvetuximab, and showed that that is a safe combination and that there is an added clinical benefit in some of those lower expression subgroups if we add bevacizumab into the mix. So for those women who don't have high risk factors and can safely receive bevacizumab, just like with those standard of care chemotherapies, adding Bev tends to make this more efficacious. So in summary, platinum-resistant ovarian cancer is a really difficult place. For treatment of ovarian cancer, your options are much more modest and much more limited, that we often need platinum-free chemotherapy options or targeted therapy options, and the addition of mirvetuximab to that milieu is very beneficial for these patients, and I think that there will be continued development in this antibody-drug conjugate world in the coming years as we keep taking advantage of this mechanism. There are some unique toxicities that come with this therapy, and as we're all going to be seeing this more and more in practice, we're going to spend some time today talking about how to recognize those, how to manage those, and then the future of these therapies. I will wrap it up there.
I'm going to keep you up there for a second.
So okay.
Thank you. We got a couple of questions that I think are actually really great, and one of them will lead into the cases that we're going to discuss, but I want to start with one question, and I'll piggyback and we can help you answer these. But does the MTHFR gene affect the mirvetuximab drug in any way?
I actually am not sure of that.
It's a great question. So this is the methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase gene, if I remember correctly. I might have gotten that acronym a little bit wrong. You know, the interesting thing about ADCs is they target expression on the tumor cell. So a gene mutation may not actually make it higher sensitivity to that mutation. So you think about trastuzumab and an amplification of HER2 versus trastuzumab deruxtecan and expression of HER2. So it's a little bit of a different approach to how that therapy works. But I don't know the answer to that. So I think it's very provocative. And I don't know if those cells that have that mutation, which honestly, I don't even know how present that is in ovarian cancer, if they actually have higher rates of expression. So you've given me some homework to do because I think it's a really provocative question. Mm-hmm. And then the next question is folate receptor alpha expression a part of path reports on these patients, or is it something that needs to be added on?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So where we include molecular testing in the workup of platinum-resistant ovarian cancer is often very provider-dependent, but at least in my practice, with any new platinum-resistant or platinum-refractory recurrence, I would typically recommend a new biopsy whenever feasible so that we can get new molecular testing on that, because sometimes expression within tumors changes over time, and so a new look at what's happening molecularly can be really valuable. In general, it's an institutional practice. So we have worked really hard here at the University of Colorado to make this part of our upfront reporting for ovarian cancers, that every ovarian cancer patient gets folate receptor alpha status reported. I would say that's relatively rare that programs have instituted that nationally. So often this is something that you have to go seek out with whatever, you know, pick your poison of all the companies out there that can do molecular testing, but it's often something you have to go add to the mix.
And just to piggyback on that, when you do the commercial third-party testing, you can order the IHC for folate receptor testing. It reads out as FOLR1, so it's a little bit, you know, we're saying alpha folate expression, but that's actually how it reads out on most of these tests. And we also send it out because our pathologists feel like there's too much variability. So you're looking at intensity and the quantity of staining. So having it standardized is probably the best thing, especially when you're looking at percentages. This, you know, it's not just positive, negative. There's a couple more questions. Just briefly, I want to ask you because I think these are really great questions. The first one's a yes or no. Can you rechallenge with Bev?
Yeah, absolutely. I am a big fan of reutilization of bevacizumab in this space, since it's augmenting the efficacy of our relatively limited set of therapeutic options here. So unless a patient has a contraindication to bevacizumab for other reasons, hypertension, proteinuria, high risk of bowel perforation, unless there is some clinical contraindication, I often rechallenge with bevacizumab.
And me, myself as well, and Emily, I'll let you speak to it as well. I think it's a great avenue, and I like the idea of combining it with new agents, so I think that also opens the doors.
Yes, and we see a lot of rechallenging with Bev in our practice as well, and then with Merv, yes, definitely seeing it in combination. So
the last question is about the expression rate, and I think we're going to answer this in the case, and if we don't, we'll come back to it. But I just want to thank Jill for her excellent presentation. All right, so we're going to do some case challenges, and these are really kind of scenarios that we see quite frequently in our clinics. So I'm going to start with a 49-year-old patient who has advanced ovarian cancer, and she's referred for molecular testing. And so the first question I want to kind of address is, what tests are recommended at diagnosis of advanced disease, and when should they be repeated? And we kind of touched upon this, and I'm going to ask I'm going to make sure I didn't miss anything. I'm going to ask my panel, so what tests do you get at the time of diagnosis?
Yeah, so I get both germline and somatic BRCA and homologous recombination testing at diagnosis. Our institution happens to also report out folate receptor alpha 1 expression, but in general, I really want homologous recombination information to start with, since that's informing my maintenance therapy plan decisions. And then I pursue more targeted third-party molecular testing at the time of recurrence.
And I would say BRCA, for sure, and germline is all very standard up front. And then, yes, I agree. I don't order these tests, but our physician teams who do definitely go in more detail once we're at the PROC stage.
Yeah, and we do a similar thing. We get NGS testing pretty much standardly on all of our ovarian cancer. So we're actually getting a lot of information that may be useful down the road. You heard Jill say that about 80% of these patients will recur with advanced disease. And so having that information up front may not be relevant at that moment, but may be informative down the road. I think the question is about, you know, is a new biopsy needed at the time of recurrent disease? And so when do you repeat molecular testing? Let's say you have a panel. When and why do you repeat it? And how often do you push for a new biopsy in patients?
I think, at least in my practice, it depends a lot on the site of that recurrent lesion. If it's in a very biopsy accessible, safe area, in general, my preference is to get a biopsy whenever that's feasible. And I often send new molecular testing on a new biopsy. That being said, there are going to be lesion locations where biopsy access isn't feasible and is not safe. And in those settings, we can use imaging and other clinical factors to feel confident in the diagnosis of a recurrence without a biopsy.
Anything to add?
Nothing to add.
I totally agree. And I think, you know, when we get the testing information up front, if it's positive, I use it to my advantage. If it's negative, I might be sneaky and do a new biopsy, because we don't know if these profiles may change with time. There's differences in timing, like a tumor may change over time, but there's also differences in location. So there's tumor heterogeneity, you know, in an omental lesion versus an ovarian lesion. So I think it's always something important to consider. And so we touched upon this a little bit about when do you test for folate receptor alpha expression. You know, we often get this time information at diagnosis, and Jill already mentioned that if you don't have it, when the patient recurs, it's definitely the time you want to get it. You mentioned the platforms and methods. This is an IHC testing, and I'm going to share some of the IHC expression with you. NeoGenomics produces the antibody that makes this, and that's usually, you can send it out. When this first got approved, they were doing it for free. Now I think there's a charge, but most of the third-party companies are doing it. So it's easy to order. It's unlikely that your institution's doing it unless you're at a very specific institution that has like a high interest in this. And then we talked about the need to repeat the testing. I always think a fresher biopsy is always more informative. It may help find a clinical trial that the patient's a candidate for, but it's not always possible, or patients may not always want that. So I think it's always a good discussion to have with patients. And Jill, I'm going to point this question at you. How do you specifically define FR alpha positivity, and what are the implications of this, since you touched upon this?
Yeah, I think that from an FDA approval standpoint, 75%+ expression is our cutoff for sort of making treatment decisions. I do think the last study I was talking to you all about with the addition of bevacizumab does open this up a little bit more. Perhaps that 50-75% expression group, if we combine the mirvetuximab with bevacizumab, we can add some benefit in that setting. Less than 50%, though, I'm often not pursuing this therapy.
And I think it's important when you document it in the charts, or if you note it, instead of putting negative or positive, actually put the expression rate, because there are new generations of alpha folate targets coming out that may have varying degrees of expression targets or combinations that may change that. And, you know, just to be clear, the FDA has approved mirvetuximab for platinum-resistant ovarian cancer with 75% or higher expression. The NCCN does have a label for mirvetuximab and bevacizumab in 50% or higher. So, you know, I think we're going to start seeing more maybe exploitation of this target with different combinations where the percentage may matter. And so this is just kind of a review of what we recommend at timing. And I just want to highlight that germline testing for any patient with epithelial ovarian cancer is recommended. So that is something to just consider. But germline testing for BRCA1 and 2 are the most common mutations. There are also other homologous recombination repair. So you'll hear us refer to HRD. That's homologous recombination deficiency or a mutation in one of these genes that kind of affects that pathway. BRIP1, RAD51C, RAD51D, PALB2, there's a handful of them. And the reason why this is so important is the germline testing or somatic BRCA mutations or HRD status can kind of help encourage the patient or your recommendation for the patient to utilize a PARP inhibitor as maintenance therapy, and then also for germline testing. Also for germline testing for a patient's family if she tests positive. And this goes for somatic testing. And along with that somatic testing, getting mismatch repair deficiency testing is recommended in specific subtypes. Clear cell and endometrioid, we often get it kind of across the board because of the NGS testing, which we get with microsatellite instability, but also can inform genetic risk as well as targeted therapies with immunotherapy down the road. And then the folate receptor alpha expression at the time of diagnosis can be done, but definitely at the time of recurrence. And positivity is defined as 75% or higher. I don't know where that mouse is either. That's kind of creeping me out. I'm probably on it. molecular test, if the patient develops it. If you don't have molecular testing at primary diagnosis, this is a critical time to get it. And it's interesting to note that patients may develop mutations. It's unlikely to develop a BRCA mutation. If anything, they may develop a reversion or resistance to BRCA mutation, or it may reverse. But mismatch repair testing, MSI, and then there are some other emerging therapies that there are targets for, like BRAF, RET, HER2, which we'll talk a little bit about, and NTRK. And I always joke, if you see an NTRK or a RET fusion, you have a great target for it, which is awesome. I have yet to see one in my 20 years of practice. Testing at the time of recurrence may not be necessary, but if you feel like the tumor biology may change, and sometimes in a mixed response where patients, some disease is getting smaller but some is getting bigger, that might be a good opportunity. And identifying alpha folate receptor positive patients is really important, and this should really be standard care for patients with recurrent ovarian cancer. Epithelial ovarian cancer is really the priority, so those high-grade serous carcinoma patients are most likely to have this. And just for kind of overview, we see folate receptor expression in about 60% of ovarian cancers, but high expression probably in about 30%. And so, you know, somebody asked about what we see this in PROC. We see that at the time when it's tested. I don't know how many of those patients were PROC, but we would imagine that hopefully it hasn't changed if they haven't received folate receptor alpha targeted therapy. And then in these patients who are platinum resistant, it really is something that should be tested. We are also seeing it in low-grade cancers. We don't have therapeutic targets, but keep your eye on that as well. And I mentioned the expression. This is just an example of expression. So I've talked to our pathologists about doing it in-house, and they're like, no, thank you, because it is kind of dual testing. You have this low, medium, high expression, and then a staining intensity. So the number of cells and the percentage of cells, if you will, and then how intense they stain. And then they have this rubric that they just put with negative, very low, low, medium, and high. And you can see here the distribution, about 30 or 40% are high, but a fair number of patients will have some level of expression in ovarian cancer. So definitely worth testing. Note down the percentage. And I would say don't be shy to retest. If a patient has access to it and you can give them this therapy, it might be a good option for them. So I'm going to ask my panel again, are there any barriers to molecular testing, including folate receptor alpha, minus the send out? Emily, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think access to some of this testing may not be feasible. You know, we have the luxury of working at large academic medical centers where things like this can be easily done, but I know that isn't true everywhere else, so I know access has been something that people have mentioned in the past as well.
Jill, anything that you've seen that's been a barrier?
I think that just provider knowledge about this being kind of the new standard of care can sometimes be a limitation. But you know, a lot of third-party molecular testing companies are eager to be there to support you in this testing and to find ways around cost barriers or access barriers. So I think that knowledge is the barrier, yeah. I see.
And most insurances will cover this, so hopefully the patient's not seeing any direct cost. There are barriers, you know, if tissue sampling may be it, there's variability in interpretations. And then the Ventana alpha folate receptor assay, which NeoGenomics has, and that's the one that actually all the third parties use. And then I think the biggest gap is just not being aware that this is an option for our patients, so the testing just never gets done or doesn't get interpreted in an appropriate fashion. So I think you guys being here, I think it really shows the impact that these programs have, where we can share this information, share it with your colleagues, especially those who don't treat ovarian cancer as frequently. And then once again, you know, education initiatives and standardization. Now that these third-party companies are doing it and most people know about BRCA, it's kind of getting done automatically. We just need to know to look for it. And a lot of these companies will put, hey, this patient's a candidate for mirvetuximab, so they're actually even highlighting it for us. You know, I think the other thing that I want to highlight is non-invasive alternatives. We're not really sure if blood-based assays are good enough because, remember, it's the expression level. So we have a little bit more to learn on here, but that may be something in the future where we can use blood tests instead of tumor testing to determine the patient's sensitivity to some of these therapies. So I'm going to move case two to Emily, and I thank you for your participation and questions. Keep them coming.
Hello, everyone. Okay, so case number two. A 58-year-old woman with folate receptor alpha positive platinum-resistant ovarian cancer has started mirvetuximab and is experiencing severe ocular symptoms, including dry eyes and blurred vision. So how do you explain this therapeutic decision of selecting mirvetuximab to your patient? What evidence is available to support this treatment selection? Panelists, do you want to add anything before I start?
I would say hopefully we've answered this for you. We've had several clinical trials done over time that we've learned a lot from to help inform this, including Soraya and Mirasol, and then most recently the addition of bevacizumab.
Yep, phase three data.
Cool. And this is a great summary slide of what both Ritu and Jill have gone through today in terms of the clinical trials that really made mirvetuximab stand out and really demonstrated not only safety but the tolerability. I think the biggest take point for nursing, being that I am a CNS and I teach, there's so many drugs coming down the pipeline, so it's very important that you really learn. I always say learn the top four things of every drug, and that's really what you need to know. And here it is: ocular, GI, fatigue, and neuropathy. Those are the big ones that came out in these studies. But what's important about the slide is, yes, there was good percentages of all grades, but what you can see is that very little percentages of the grade three or higher's were noted. And so most of the time we're talking about grade one or two in terms of side effects, which means we can probably manage these really well. And we'll talk more about how do we prepare our patients for this information moving forward. And again, I think our panelists have already done a great job to tell you the efficacy of MIRVA, but the Mirasol trial was a great one, really showing that progression-free survival, which is, again, in ovarian cancer, I don't know about all of you, for years I was like, I need some hope in this disease, and I think here we are getting some of that. So, again, higher objective response rates, overall survival advantage was very clear in the mirvetuximab group versus the investigator's choice of chemotherapy. By the way, in that trial, they did the chemotherapies that were looked at were paclitaxel, topotecan, and pegylated doxorubicin in terms of the investigator choice chemotherapies, which many of you are familiar. There's also some really cool data around the health-related quality of life around in the MIRV groups. Better GI and abdominal GI symptom control was noted. A lot of meaningful health-related quality of life preservation at critical time points throughout the study, which was important. And again, no significant health-related quality of life detriment in relation to these ocular events. But what was super, super important is, again, in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer therapies, we often trade efficacy for toxicity. But MIRV was a game changer because it was able to show that it delivered both superior efficacy and tolerability, which in this disease, as you all know, we typically hit a point where we can't go further because the toxicities are so significant, or the disease just progresses. So again, it's a huge game changer.
Okay, so what do we know about the reasons why these ocular toxicities are observed with this antibody drug conjugate? What are the presenting symptoms of ocular toxicity, and how should we be managing and diagnosing these? Any thoughts, opening thoughts?
Yeah, I'll start. So, you know, it's a really interesting thing. We don't quite understand why these ocular toxicities occur, but they're probably on the eye, some of these alpha receptor that can kind of, there's endocytosis of the molecule, and so it can cause some eye toxicities. There are ways to kind of reduce some eye toxicities. So there's mitigation strategies that we use, which I think we're going to talk about shortly, so I won't belabor that. But I do think that the most common thing we see are more vision disturbances. So patients will complain about blurry vision. They'll note like floaters or eye pain or photophobia. And this is different than some of the other eye toxicities we see with other ADCs, which may be more like keratitis. So it's a really interesting thing that the eye can be affected differently depending on which drug it is.
I don't have anything else to add. Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Well, and there we go. So, interestingly enough, again, we've mentioned keratopathy refers to the damage or disease that causes changes in the structure or the function of the cornea. I'm not going to go into super detail, but it's a great image of, depending on where the damage is happening, what are the symptoms, so the dry eyes, the keratitis that you can see, the conjunctivitis, et cetera. And here was the ocular toxicity profile with MIRV in the three trials. And again, blurred vision was very presenting in many, many patients. And so for nursing, please, you know, make notes of these things, because when you know what the most common symptoms is, this is what we need to be teaching patients to look out for. And then dry eyes, and of course, good percentages were noted, but again, mostly grade one and twos, very small percentages in the grade three and higher. Really, what's interesting is we don't think it's the actual target of folate receptor alpha that's causing this issue, because that's expressed in the human cornea. It's actually the DM4 payload, that kind of taxane-like chemotherapy component to the drug conjugate, that we think is what's causing the primary cause of these ocular toxicities in MIRV. So I thought that was very interesting. And this is my soapbox. A lot of my nurses come to me and say, oh, it's an antibody. Antibody drug conjugates are not just a mAb. They have three different components, and we really need to start learning what is causing what so that we can really teach our patients how to manage our AIs with these drugs. So let's see. What are the key elements of a care plan to mitigate ocular toxicity side effects, including coordinating care with ophthalmology? Are there any prophylactic strategies that we should be using to reduce the risk of developing these toxicities?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that having a strong collaboration with ophthalmology is essential in using antibody drug conjugate therapies across cancer types, because these eye toxicities are new for us, and we're learning how to navigate them. I typically will have these patients routinely see ophthalmology before every infusion, or at least every other infusion, and several prophylactic drops that we can talk about here in a moment to help prevent or treat any symptoms that they have.
I think the other thing is just have patients report their symptoms. You know, I always worry about patients minimizing their symptoms because they're worried about coming off a drug. But, you know, the interesting thing about this drug is I think it was 100% reversibility of any of the eye toxicities. So reassuring them that, hey, we can kind of manage this and monitor this, but we don't want to get to the point where we start reporting irreversible toxicities. So counseling the patients early on, encouraging them to use the eye drops, and we give them checklists and, you know, their steroid eye drops and vasoconstricting eye drops and the ophthalmology visits.
Well, there we go. And here's the eye care for mirvetuximab. So again, it did occur in 59% of patients in the MIRASOL trial, again with 53%, so almost all with complete resolution, with a small percentage of partial resolution. Again, ophthalmic exams at baseline. Recommendations are prior to every other infusion times 8 cycles, and then as clinically indicated. The two eye drops should be prescribed, should be a lubricating eye drop and a corticosteroid. Below is a really cool graph of the timing. I actually, in my institution and in our infusion centers, I don't start the treatment unless I know they have them. We ask them to bring them, and we confirm that they know what they're doing. This is complicated. You know, you start one the day before, you do the other one day of. So if you guys are doing chemo teachers, those out there, I think a nice graph is helpful, especially with those patients who have a hard time following the little bottle instructions. But again, the steroids start the day before infusion, followed. It's 6 times daily, so it's not a joke. One drop on each eye, day before through day four, and then on day five, we drop it down to four times a day through day eight. The lubricating eye drops are PRN, four times a day, daily, but again, I just make sure they have them both and are ready to roll before we get started with therapy.
And I apologize, I said vasoconstricting, but it is lubricating. And then tell the patient to avoid contacts because that can also irritate their eyes and increase their eye toxicity.
And then a big note, teaching point is waiting 10 minutes in between the corticosteroid drops and the lubricating just to make sure that we're not washing out the corticosteroids eye drops. So it should be noted on the bottle as well to have that 10-minute in between. This is really what do we do once these ocular adverse events are occurring. Really grade one, we're saying monitor for worsening symptoms and you can continue the MIRV at the same dose. Grade two, at this point it's recommended that you hold treatment until either improves to grade one or baseline with maybe weekly symptomatic assessments, whether it be on the phone, video visits, however is feasible for the patient. If the ocular symptoms have lasted less than 14 days, it's recommended you can resume at the same dose of MIRV. However, if the ocular symptoms lasted kind of in that 14 or higher up to 28 days, it's recommended that you resume the MIRV at a lower dose. Grades three, it's going to depend, is it the first occurrence or have they had multiple occurrences? But you're going to hold again until grade one or baseline. You're going to resume depending on if it's their first occurrence, you can go ahead and resume with the same dose, but I think if it's multiple recurrences of this grade three, you're probably going to have to dose reduce the patient. And grade four, we really should be permanently discontinuing the therapy. So, what are the best counseling strategies for our patients in identifying ocular toxicities and the importance of adhering to treatment in the event of experiencing AE? Anything you want to add other than?
I think that this is a place where a pre-therapy teaching session is just of absolute paramount importance for patients to understand that these toxicities are common and that they're manageable, and the importance of those eye drops is really key. And I think that as providers, we really need to facilitate those discussions about having patients be open with whatever they're experiencing, knowing that there are lots of ways we can navigate dose reductions or holds, and that reporting symptoms does not mean they're done with therapy. And then there are lots of different strategies out there. I've heard of apps that can be creative in helping patients remember to do their eye drops, so you can help support patients in the complexity of that.
Yeah, I agree.
And here we go. So again, that early on education to patients on what to expect, which symptoms are common. Again, blurred vision, dry eyes, eye pain, and photophobia, which I didn't mention earlier. It's the slight sensitivity that can definitely occur. And really, a lot of patients think things are normal, and I think we really need to encourage them to let us know anything new around the eyes we need to know as soon as possible. Again, I think Jill highlighted this, but also explaining to patients that because we have to either dose reduce or hold does not mean you're failing this therapy. It's just what we need to do to manage the side effects, and understanding that we do expect these to happen. We saw how many patients do experience these ocular toxicities. We have strategies we need to know early on, but there is still a benefit with the MIRV, and just because we're dose reducing or holding temporarily does not mean you have failed therapy. I think that there's a lot of stigma with patients when they think that we're holding things or having to take a break, that things are going to go wrong, and it's not necessarily true. It's just we need to keep them safe. But again, the sooner we know, the better we can keep them on therapy at the timely manner and frequency that they should be getting their infusions. Anything else on that case?
No, but we have some questions.
Cool.
Since we have a little extra
here.
Time. Is it okay if I keep you
yes.
there and just
yes.
So someone asked, is there a REMS or a risk evaluation management? I don't know what the S stands for. Program because of eye symptoms.
Say that again.
Is there a REMS program because of eye symptoms?
I am not sure. Does anybody know?
I don't think there is that I've seen, and I've been using this drug for several years, but I do know that the FDA does ask that if you have a unique toxicity or irreversible toxicity, that you do report it, and that's standard for any therapy. But I don't know of any specific REMS program.
Same.
And this next question, I actually think, Emily, you're the best one to answer this. Are the percentages of eye toxicities in those receiving ADCs the same in male versus female patients? Now, I don't treat males. Jill doesn't treat males, so we're turning it to you.
I don't treat males either. I don't know.
Well, okay. I thought you had more comprehensive
yeah.
exposure.
You have a gynecologic.
Yeah, so I'm so sorry. I don't know that, but mirvetuximab does not have an indication in any other cancer besides
right.
ovarian cancer at this time. So if you're looking at, if you want to know the answer, probably lymphoma where they're using vedotin is probably the best one, but I don't know the answer. It's a great question.
Yeah, interesting.
And then is there any advice related to cryotherapy to eye area?
Oh, yes. So there is some cooling instructions in some of these that we do before, during, and after the infusion, if I recall. And the way I teach it is we actually just have the patients do, you know, like your gloves that you wear to give chemo because they're meant to be on your hands. We just have them put ice in that, and they can cool beforehand. And they sit on the eye pocket much better than those ice packs that you all probably have in your infusion centers. So that's what we do for cooling.
And then these are just kind of generic questions, so I'll put Jill on the hot seat again. What are the three most important questions that a woman should ask when she finds out she has ovarian cancer to give her the best treatment outcome?
I think that having your patients ask about genetic testing and molecular testing is very, very important, both for their own treatment planning, maintenance strategies, future therapeutic options, as well as for cascade testing of loved ones and their own second cancer risks. So I think for best outcomes, genetic testing is paramount. I think that having patients really explore what are all of the options and understanding the pros and cons of different therapies. So in the platinum-resistant, particularly ovarian cancer space, there is no clear textbook of it's this and then it's this and then it's this, right? It's not always a nice lineup recipe of what we're going to use. It's very individualized for cancer distribution, for patient side effects or baseline medical issues, for their molecular testing, weighing of toxicities, you know, neuropathy, myelosuppression, can they tolerate eye toxicity, bevacizumab, like these toxicities have to be really carefully weighed. So I think patients really need to be given multiple options and the pros and cons of all options.
I'll put a third one in there. I think it's when surgery can play an integral part of, it's kind of like the primary part of the primary treatment, make sure you're being operated on by a gynecologic oncologist. I think we see a lot of patients who get surgery by general surgery, general GYN, and there's actually data that shows that survival is impacted by who does your surgery. So make sure if you have any say or patient, make sure they're seeing a gynecologic oncologist, if feasible. I know some areas don't have it, but if feasible.
And in that same vein, I would say that even if a medical oncologist is providing the chemotherapy portion of patient's care, a GYN oncologist should still be involved in chemotherapy decision-making because drugs like mirvetuximab are things that are our day-to-day. This is the bread and butter of what we're doing, and it may not be forefront of non-gynecologic providers' minds. And so we can be an adjunct to medical oncology care. We should be involved. GYN oncology should be involved.
And these last two questions, I want to address them. I know we're a little bit over, but I just want to address them in the spirit of interaction. So is folate receptor alpha included in NGS panels, or do you have to request it? There usually is a box for IHC testing, and if you check that box for, like, you know, different commercial assays, it is an IHC testing that's done by the companies that do NGS. It's not technically NGS, so you just have to request it. If you didn't get it, you can actually just do alpha folate receptor testing request, but it's a IHC testing, and NeoGenomics has the form for that, which you can easily pull up online. Email me. I'm happy to give it to you as well. And then how often do you see an insufficient sample or failed test? It's actually pretty infrequent. You know, we have archival tumor, and then we have the opportunity to get new biopsies if needed. But sometimes, you know, we get a little blinded by where we are. Do you have any comments on that?
No, I think it's quite rare. You know, we're using archival old tissue, right? We don't absolutely have to have a new biopsy if it's not feasible, and I think that's a pretty darn rare circumstance.
All right, let's move on to case three.
Great questions. Okay, case three. 67-year-old patient with a history of folate receptor alpha positive platinum-resistant ovarian cancer being treated with mirvetuximab develops treatment-related adverse events, or TRAEs. How should AEs such as GI disturbances and fatigue be managed in patients treated with MIRVA? Discuss the importance of nutrition management as well as the use of antiemetics for nausea and vomiting. And then, you know,
should we be developing personalized care plans for the management of fatigue with a focus on a plan that considers patient daily activities? Any thoughts?
No, I mean, I think, again, kind of like eye toxicity, I think you just have to be forthcoming in your teaching about the expected, at least grade one, grade two adverse events that we anticipate, and these are two big players.
And it's interesting because a lot of patients with recurrent ovarian cancer may already have GI issues because of the disease. And so, you know, Jill showed you, or actually I think Emily showed you the data about the quality of life improving. You know, sometimes it's managing and then these symptoms actually get better with time because the disease is responding and the drug may not be as, it's probably a contributing factor, but maybe not the main contributing factor. Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, I was literally going to say exactly that, that, again, these patients at baseline probably already have a lot going on in terms of GI disturbances and discomfort, and we hope with the therapy that things improve. But I think super important that antiemetics are being given with each infusion of mirvetuximab to reduce nausea and vomiting. And, again, home prescription for antiemetics I think is also key so that patients, you know, many of our patients don't live close to our center, so it's important that they have ways to manage their nausea and vomiting at home. And again, if you have supportive care services like nutritionists, I mean, they are the pros. It's really hard to keep telling patients, keep your weight normal, but don't lose too much, don't gain too much, eat well, stay hydrated. I mean, that's a lot to do even for me. So imagine someone on with cancer of this kind that's so difficult to manage. So please use your supportive care services like your nutritionists. And then fatigue, I mean, you know, we all love talking about it, but patients find it so interesting that exercise is the one thing that we should, that they should do to help with fatigue because it seems so counterintuitive. But I also remind nurses, don't overwhelm them. It doesn't mean go on a treadmill every day. It's simple things, I guess short walks. You know, I tell patients, go 15 minutes around the block, you know, where you live or to the park or walk your dog. Light exercise is just as fair as, you know, if they want to do anything more than that. But also conservation strategies, you know, these patients can get very, very, very exhausted and they really should be consolidating things that they're doing or getting help if they need to and then taking breaks when they need to. Recommending consistent sleep, I can't speak enough. I did my thesis on sleep disturbances in women with cancer, and it's not just falling asleep and having a routine to fall asleep, but it's getting out of bed. I have people tell me they've been in bed for 16 hours, not good. So I say things like, get up, get to a dining table, eat your breakfast, get out of bed, take a shower, just small little things they can do because otherwise this can be a very chronic and difficult thing to get over. And again, using folks like your occupational therapist, if you have access to them, to helping them with management strategies. Okay, so the next fun one, neuropathy, one of my favorite topics. How often should we be assessing patients for TRAEs such as peripheral neuropathy, and what are some key questions that we should be asking our patients about this?
Yeah, I mean, we are often very used to talking about peripheral neuropathy in the spaces of, you know, upfront Taxol chemotherapy, and I ask about this at every single visit with patients on mirvetuximab because I think of it in the same way as I do taxane-induced peripheral neuropathy, that if we just barrel through, right, if we just keep things at the same dose, we don't address them, that we can really impact quality of life in a time where quality of life is of utmost importance. And I think we have to be on top of this so that we can make adjustments with therapeutic options or dose reductions.
Yeah. Excuse me. I agree. I think the, you know, the difference is with platinum and taxane in frontline, you have a hard stop. Here, you may be able to continue this patient on for long periods, ideally long periods of time, and so addressing this is really important. I will say, you know, neuropathy is probably my single, like my least favorite toxicity of all of them, and, you know, we deal with quite a bit. It can be really debilitating for the patient, so make sure you're asking the patient the right question. Is it affecting your activities of daily living? Are you able to put on earrings or pick up a pen, do your buttons on your shirt? You know, asking these questions can be helpful to really kind of getting down to the nitty-gritty. It's not just the numbness and tingling. It actually may affect their fine motor skills as well.
And you guys literally took the words out of my mouth.
Exactly.
Every visit, guys, every visit. And remember, we're not seeing them for 3 weeks, so a lot can change in that time frame. I agree with, sure, we can ask the normal, do you have numbness, tingling? A lot of patients will say ants crawling. That's another feeling they feel, burning sensations. But don't say, do you have any issues with your fine motor tasks? They're not going to know what that means. So I love the, I do the same. Do you have difficulties buttoning your pants or your shirts or lifting things or tying your shoes? Give them examples because then they'll go, oh, actually, yeah, that's actually become really hard, or
you know, things like that. And again, daily activities, it's also, is there anything affecting their balance, their gait, that has changed? And I always say, has anything changed, worsened, or is there anything new since the last time we saw you, which I think is also really important. Okay, and then how do we manage this? Rethi pointed out, this is one of the hardest ones. It can be extremely difficult for patients and for us as providers, because you can see how difficult it could be for a patient. But what about some pharmacological versus non-pharmacological strategies? Any best practices in terms of developing a care plan, in terms of their functional status, assisted devices? What dosing adjustments should we consider, or treatment delays? And then any tips for managing neuropathy at home?
Yeah, I'll start this one. I think about this in certain things. There's things I can do as a physician. I can dose interrupt. I can dose reduce. And those are things I always talk to patients about. Once I dose reduce, I don't go back up. So I make sure the patient understands that, hey, this is something we're doing to prevent this from becoming more significant. Neuropathy, unfortunately, can be irreversible. So this may be a lifelong experience for the patients. And then there's pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic interventions that we can do. So things that like gabapentin or other nerve-targeting medications, now those kind of mask the symptoms. So you can do things like vitamin B complex supplementation, alpha-lipoic acid, and then, you know, we get creative. And I think actually patients doing exercises can also help just getting the blood flow, but also acupuncture. And we actually are lucky we have an East-West Medicine clinic that does acupuncture for our patients with neuropathy, and I think that's really helpful. Somebody asked in the questions about cryotherapy for neuropathy, and I think absolutely, decreasing the blood flow during the infusion may actually help protect the end nerves, but some of the neuropathy may not just be limited to the hands and feet. I have a patient who has hearing loss because of neuropathy secondary to mirvetuximab, so, you know, unless she does an ice bath, we're probably not going to hit every nerve, but I think it definitely is the ones that the patients use the most, so hands, you know, cold socks, cold gloves, can definitely help, and I think it's something we should start advocating pretty universally for our patients.
Yeah, I would say I strongly recommend these patients get in with acupuncture, and we actually use a lot of topical cannabinoids in this situation as well as a therapeutic option.
And definitely, we mentioned the pharmacological options that are out there. And again, when they are having neuropathic pain, can be very helpful or very painful neuropathy with things like duloxetine. But I third the acupuncture. Women tell me how incredible acupuncture can be for neuropathy. We are lucky to have the Osher Center, which is our alternative medicine, and have access to those referrals. So things like that can be super helpful that are non-pharmacologically related. Things like strength exercises, blood flow. And in terms of cryotherapy, if they're naive to taxanes early on when they first get diagnosed, it's always a great time to do the cryotherapy because the chemo hasn't hit. So if you can really prevent, you can kind of cool them down so low that early on it's great, but it doesn't mean it doesn't work in this stage. But just as a reminder to nurses, most of your patients who've recurred have probably had a good course of taxanes in the past. So we might already have some baseline neuropathy, so keep that in mind as you're assessing your patients. And again, making sure, I always say nurses are the ones that discover the walking issues, even though they don't tell you. They go to the bathroom and you're like, Emily doesn't look, she's not walking the same way she was last time. Those are always the little things, their gait is off, they're walking a little different. We need to start thinking about falls at home and preventing injury. Again, using physical therapy and occupational therapists if needed to help with any of these sort of gait issues that they may have at home. So just remember safety at home, but also when they're with you. And then we mentioned the dose adjustment versus treatment delay. So again, general recommendations, grade 2 of neuropathy, consider a dose reduction from 6 milligrams per kilogram to 5, using, again, the adjusted ideal body weight. For grade 3 neuropathy, you may need to hold until improvement at less than grade 2 or less, and then resume at a reduced dose. And it sounds like we typically don't go back to that initial dose once we've reduced. Grade 4, again, you're discontinuing likely therapy. So. And then home management, again, warm, cold for comfort, comfortable shoes. I also start to teach about wearing shoes and not being barefoot if they really are having loss of sensation under the feet, because it's kind of like your diabetic patients, you know, they can have injuries that they don't actually notice. Gentle stretching exercise can be definitely easy, and as well as, like I said, acupuncture, as we've all mentioned, and then using assisted devices if they start to need help with their gait or walking. Okay, and finally, I mean, we can't do this alone. So let's discuss the role of multidisciplinary teams in the management of these treatment toxicities.
Yes, it is key, right? So we already heard about the ophthalmologists. Like, I now have more ophthalmology friends than I have in my lifetime. And I think the other folks, you know, neurologists, which we didn't really mention, if you do have a patient with severe neuropathy, can be helpful. You know, our other medical oncology colleagues, we learn from them as well and learn tips and tricks. You heard about acupuncturists. So there, this requires a lot of people to help take care of this, you know, these patients.
I would also say that my standard practice is that when a patient has a new platinum-resistant or refractory ovarian cancer, we're talking at that diagnosis also about involving palliative care for symptom optimization. And there are also physical medicine and rehab doctors who have a lot of oncology expertise in these complex symptom support strategies. So I think you've got some additional resources there as well.
So here's the teams. I mean, you know, we can't do it alone. I also acknowledge our pharmacists, who I cannot do my job without. They are so helpful to our providers when we're doing these dose adjustments, dose reductions, holding therapy, having communication about that. Of course, our physical and occupational therapists, nutritionists. And don't forget the mental health piece to this. This is a very debilitating disease on its own. Nonetheless, when we start adding therapies that have all these other toxicities. So, I mean, we have a wonderful psycho-onc group and symptom management group that we definitely refer patients. I would say as we start to see the recurrence, it's definitely time to start involving other people. And, of course, I'm biased, all you wonderful nurses in the room. I mean, you guys are seeing the patients. You know them well. They know you, and you are the people that catch those little nuances, even if they don't tell you. And our incredible oncologists who, again, partner with us to get these patients through their treatment. So, definitely, it takes a village. And that's no joke. And again, finally, what are our best practices in counseling regarding patients to what to expect with MIRV, the importance of early reporting? I think we've already hit some of that, but especially with neuropathy. And then what about self-treatment of these AEs and kind of when to seek care versus what they can do at home, which I think is a challenge for patients to know, not to call us for everything, but, you know, when should they?
Yeah, we use our nurses to do pre-education. So before they start this, just similar to what Jill was saying, you know, they kind of get an overview of what to expect, when to call, what to report. And then, you know, we leave it open that if you have questions that we didn't cover. But I think we also say, hey, if you start experiencing this, try this at home. And so we try to give them some encouragement to take a little bit of more ownership of some of the symptoms and see what they can do at home before escalating. But of course, we always want to be there to address any issues.
And again, so I think anything you could do up front, especially in those chemo teaches, to prepare them for what's coming is always helpful. Really, these are sort of the big ones, so teaching that this is it could be expected, but that we have a plan on how we're going to manage these toxicities, I think, is really important. And then, again, emphasizing when things are new or worsening is really when we want to know and to let us know as soon as possible. And explaining that really early intervention is key, right, to worsening, preventing worsening side effects that can actually, you know, if we can manage sooner, we may be able to avoid delays or dose reductions or having to hold treatment, which I think is really important for patients to know. And again, at home, you know, for minor fatigue, we've talked about some of the interventions they could do at home for the GI symptoms, dietary, and as well as prescribed medications for antiemetics can be helpful. But again, seeking medical attention once things start to change in terms of vision or eye discomfort, severe persistent nausea, vomiting, or uncontrolled, you know, we have an urgent care that we often say, call us, we can bring you in for supportive care if you need more than what you have at home. Any new worsening or numbness in the extremities and tingling, we want to know ASAP. And any symptom that starts to affect their daily activity or function, I think, is super important to tell patients to let us know. Because that also doesn't just mean it's something related to the drug. There could be something else going on that could be contributing to this as well. Okay, do you want to summarize your part?
No, I think this kind of highlights the things that we've talked about, the key of molecular testing, so getting that alpha folate receptor testing, kind of helping overcome those barriers, remembering it is IHC, so there are specific orders. And then for the adverse events, I think you did an excellent job. That was a great summary, and I'm going to take some of those tips too. But do look at these slides. You'll have them as reference so that you can refer to them in the future. And then there are also other resources. ASCO, NCCN also have supportive care guidelines in case you need additional resources. Before you depart,
yes.
There is a question just about, are you seeing challenges of rural patients receiving MIRV and ophthalmologists who may not be familiar with the ADC toxicities? So how do you address that in the rural areas where, let's say a patient's getting it, they have a medical oncologist, GYN oncologist, but the ophthalmologist, and it doesn't have to be an ophthalmologist, it can just be any eye care doctor really, but you really want to have somebody who knows what they're doing. So how do you help educate them?
Yeah, I could tell you some things. You know, our patients, I'm at UCSF, right? So I'm in a big urban area, but most of, I think 75% of our cancer patients actually live greater than 2 hours away, and most of their, even their closest ED is in a very rural space, and often they may not be able to come to you when something is happening. So some of the things we've done, at least on the nursing part, is we've created little cards for patients with drugs that they're on and like what to look for. I might not be able to speak to every ophthalmologist in your local area, but for some very unique drugs, I have, you know, created little cards that the patients, I say, if you present to an ED, a hospital, or to see somebody, give this to them so that they know that you're on this very unique drug that, you know, they may need to kind of look into. That's one tactic. I'm not sure how to address our physician colleagues. And
go ahead.
Maybe you guys.
Yeah, I think that the pharmaceutical companies coming out with these antibody drug conjugates are aware of knowledge gaps in the ophthalmology or optometry communities, and actually have really great infrastructure to come out and do teaching for local providers, whether it's optometry or ophthalmology. And so on the websites for mirvetuximab, there are actually resources to have an ophthalmology teaching occur. There are ways to fill those knowledge gaps.
Yeah. They also have checklists of what the eye exam should include and what the metrics should be. So that's another way. And if you don't have the CTCAE app, it's free, download it, because it can also help you grade the eye toxicities or other toxicities if you're just not sure what grade the patient is. And I use that pretty frequently.
And I know some of our specialty clinics have established relationships with partners in the community and kind of serve as the resource, like, you know, our derm onc person at UC will maybe serve as a content expert for somebody in Placerville or wherever, somewhere far, and just say, hey, if you have any of my patients, like, reach out to me. So I think also some of that developing relationships with people in the community where, you know, your patients are being served could be helpful.
And I think if you figure out a way to do eye exams virtually, you'll probably be able to retire, because that would be huge. So thank you for your attention, and the questions have been fantastic. I'm going to do the last section on emerging therapies, but before I do, I just want to thank you. I think as physicians, I'm going to like call my nurse when I get back or today and just be like, thank you for all you guys do. We really could not do what we do for our patients without you. And if you haven't had a chance today and you play Wordle, definitely play today. And you'll see why after you play. So we're going to talk about how treatment's evolving. You've heard about where we are today, but we know it's not good enough, right? So where can we go here from here next? And really, I want to kind of focus on how you can be instrumental in preparing for this change as new treatments start coming into the landscape for our patients. And you heard a lot about antibody-drug conjugates in the context of mirvetuximab. This is the tip of the iceberg. Antibody-drug conjugates are here. They are starting to become a part of every cancer type in the gynecologic space and many other types. This is actually an abbreviated list of the antibody-drug conjugates that are actively being studied in ovarian cancer, or gynecologic cancers, I should say, where you see ovarian's kind of a plays a role in all of these. And we have trials open for, I think, every single one of these at some capacity. And tissue factor, which is also known as tisotumab vedotin, has an FDA approval in cervical cancer. There are multiple other folate receptor alpha targets being developed. Some of these are looking at different toxicity profiles. Some of them are looking at kind of re-expression. One of the things as a physician we don't quite understand is when a patient stops responding, when the tumor stops responding to a therapy, is it resistance to the payload, the chemotherapy that's tagged in the antibody drug conjugate? Is it the receptor expression has decreased? And we don't quite understand this. So sequencing of therapies is going to be really important.
And here's a continued list of, here's a highlight of the folate receptor alpha, HER2, and tissue factor. And I'm going to throw in a couple others here that I'm really excited about. I won't belabor mirvetuximab anymore because we heard a nice overview, but I just want to highlight a benefit in PFS, OS, and quality of life. Really, this should be something our patients should do. I've had patients be really freaked out about the IA toxicities, but kind of explaining to them that these are manageable, we have mitigation strategies, we have colleagues who we work with, and we will kind of, you know, follow the recommended guidelines, but hopefully we can do better for them is really important. So, all of these are drugs that I cannot pronounce, so forgive me if I say them differently than you've heard it, because I'm going to be wrong. But luveltamab is another folate receptor targeted ADC, and it's being studied in both endometrial and ovarian cancer. It is also a folate receptor alpha target, as I mentioned. It has a different linker. It's using a hemosterolin derivative cytotoxic payload, as opposed to mirvetuximab, which is using DM4. The drug antibody ratio is just a kind of the ratio of the drug potency to the antibody. So the higher that is, kind of the higher the drug ratio is, and that can be limited by toxicity. Now, this was done. This phase one study was done in patients who had never seen folate receptor alpha, and this waterfall plot. So the ones that are going down are the ones that patients who've had responses or stable disease, and so these are pretty favorable responses. And you can see objective response rate, so partial or complete response, in about 32% of patients, which is pretty consistent with what we see with mirvetuximab. So a really interesting kind of development. And this is phase one data, so now they're going to be looking at it further. There were some treatment-related adverse events that required dose reduction in a majority of patients, and neutropenia was the biggest one. So you didn't really hear us talk a lot about hematologic toxicities in mirvetuximab. It does happen, but this one, it was kind of one of the premier side effects. So we have to kind of understand how these different targets are affecting our patients, and that might help us distinguish between one and the choosing between one and another. We saw a press release that the Luvelta had achieved an objective response rate of 32% and a disease control rate that includes stable disease of 96%, which is pretty impressive, and this was with the higher dose. So this is something that I think was, you know, pretty provocative, and we're looking at this. They are looking at patients across all levels of folate receptor alpha expression. 25% or greater had an objective response rate of 30.8%, so much better than what we see historically with chemotherapy, and then a little bit higher rates in those who have high expression. But this may actually be opening the door to those patients who have lower expression rates. Safety was pretty consistent across the two dosing groups, and no new safety signals were observed, but neutropenia is an issue with this drug. Varlatuzumab, this is another folate receptor alpha target. And here you can see that this is kind of the molecule. So this also uses a capsaicin linker and an erbulin payload, so a microtubule inhibitor. So this may have a little bit of overlapping toxicity with something like paclitaxel. And then here you can see, once again, the waterfall plot. Down is good. I guess in medicine we always do everything backwards, right? Negative is favorable, down is good. So here you can see a pretty fair response rate of patients responding or having disease control on this. And I apologize, those numbers are a little too small for me to see, but the disease control rate is pretty significant with the farlotuzumab. Once again, adverse events. And pneumonitis, we see it with mirvetuximab, we see it with trastuzumab deruxtecan, we see it with immunotherapy, and we see it with farlotuzumab. So this is something to be mindful of. I think we're getting a little bit smarter about monitoring for pneumonitis or interstitial lung disease and managing it, but it is something you want to look at, and our radiologists are also very attuned to this. Other side effects were not surprising, but nausea, fevers, malaise, and headaches. And then Rina-S is this next drug. This is another folate receptor alpha targeted therapy. So you can see this is the impact that alpha folate receptor has in this disease. And once again, this is a little bit of a smaller waterfall plot because there's less patients, but this is a little further along in clinical development. you can see really pronounced responses to patients here. One really cool thing, we have a study open with Rina-S, is they are actually looking at re-challenging patients with a folate receptor expression. So if they receive mirvetuximab, they can still go on this trial. So that kind of comes to that resistance mechanism. Maybe we'll understand why these patients are developing resistance. You can see it's a topoisomerase 1 payload. So the payload is different than what we use with mirvetuximab, even though the target is the same. This one also has cytopenia, so neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, and anemia were seen with this. But with some dose adjustments and management, it can be well managed. And then other common AEs are, not surprisingly, GI and fatigue. And because of this data, there was a press a press release March 17th that their phase 2 data using Rina-S and the higher dose actually showed a response rate of 55.6%. Now, I think in the phase 2 study, they did not allow for prior alpha folate receptor, so I don't want to confuse you. I apologize for that. But this is something that is going on to phase 3 development, and it's actively recruiting, and they are allowing for the pre-challenged patients in that study. So really impressive objective response rates, something that I think you're going to see hopefully in the future that becomes standard of care. Immunogen, or IMGN151, is another folate receptor alpha. This is like the second generation of folate receptors. So these are looking at kind of different kind of chemical compound, if you will, and it targets two different epitopes of folate receptor alpha, and its goal is to have a broader reach. So just like trastuzumab deruxtecan can be used in ultra-low, HER2 expression to high, that's what this is kind of going for, where it's looking at low, medium, and high expression. And this is the next generation. It's a similar payload to mirvetuximab, but it's DM21. And this will be something that's interesting to see if we can improve on the side effects, particularly the ocular toxicities. Someone asked about rural patients, but we also have patients who just access to care can be an issue. And having an extra visit, whether it's ophthalmology or anything else, really can be a burden to these patients. Time off work, driving. I don't know about your institution, but our institution charges an arm and a leg for parking. You know, like these can add up for these patients. So anything we can do to minimize extra visits, extra, you know, toxicities for patients is really important. So I'm excited to see the next generation of these agents and how they can maybe improve efficacy and side effects for our patients. This is a study that's ongoing, the phase 1 trial, and this is given IV every 3 weeks, and it's safety and then the recommended phase 2 dosing that's going to be determined. I'm going to spend a little time talking about trastuzumab deruxtecan. Many of you who treat other cancers are probably by far more familiar than this than I am. But there was a trial that looked at, this is a basket trial called Destiny Pan Tumor 02. And this looked at a bunch of solid tumors. All patients should have had pretreatment, and they had to have HER2 expression, either IHC, so once again, immunohistochemistry testing of 2+ or 3+. Single-arm trial of trastuzumab deruxtecan, and they had 6 cohorts of tumors and then one kind of other tumor basket. 3 of these were gynecologic cancers, and we'll focus on ovarian cancer here. The primary endpoint was objective response rate. And interestingly, prior HER2 therapy was allowed. So if a patient had received trastuzumab, they were still eligible for this trial. Here's the structure of the trastuzumab deruxtecan. It also uses a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor target, and this is something that we commonly see. So I think in sequencing, we want to make sure that the toxicities are going to be managed, and this may determine how we sequence these agents. You guys are really testing my eyes today. The HER2 testing here, they allowed for local testing, and then they did central testing as kind of confirmation. So there were some discrepancies in the testing that was done. And still today, we don't have a compendium listed or standard testing for HER2. This was gastric testing that was done, which is a little bit broader, has a larger encompassment of tumors than breast testing. So it is something when you're talking to your pathologist, we do IHC for HER2 in-house. Many, many places do because of the volume of breast cancer. So just make sure you can ask for gastric testing from your pathologist. And I remember being in the audience at ASCO when this was presented and just being kind of, I think my mouth might have even fallen open. Objective response rates were across the board remarkable. These were mostly heavily pretreated patients. I think the average number of prior regimens for ovarian cancer patients was 3, and most patients had received 5 or more, one patient receiving even up to 12. And in those patients who had immunohistochemistry 3+ expression, had a 64% response rate, which is remarkable. Remember, we were celebrating FDA approvals based on 30%. This is a 60%. I will qualify. It's 11 patients that met this metric. So our enthusiasm should be kind of asterisks, if you will. And even the patients who had IHC2 expression had a 36% response rate. So HER2 expression may be a very meaningful target for these patients. I will say that I do think these studies need to be validated in larger cohorts because we always, you know, there's always selection bias in single-arm studies. So I think it's important we validate this, but these are numbers that are pretty impressive. Here are the survival curves you can see here. These are kind of hard to interpret, but the top line is the IHC3. The orange line is the IHC2, and the middle line is the both groups combined. And just really impressive results. However, toxicities, you know, especially for us who were, this has been a new drug for, we do have to be mindful of it. And the one that, you know, I think we get most panicked about, I always joke that when mirvetuximab came out, we were so freaked out about the eye toxicities. Now we're pretty good at it. When this first came into our purview in GYN oncology, ILD is the one that kind of still gets me a little, sleepless nights. It's not common, but it can be significant. And even with grade 1, which is asymptomatic, so you see it on radiograph, you need to interrupt the treatment and make sure it resolves to grade 0. So talk to your radiologist about this and make sure you're not resuming until resolved. If the patient has symptoms, complains of shortness of breath, you notice pulse ox is decreased, you need to stop therapy and, you know, and even sometimes for grade 1, we'll initiate steroids. So you want to be really proactive on this. In April 2024, the FDA granted accelerated approval, so not full approval yet, for IHC3+ for solid tumors in patients who have received kind of standard therapy and have no ideal options. In the NCCN guidelines, it's listed as 2+ and 3+ for the gynecologic malignancies. These other drugs are really exciting. They're still in development. We call this affectionately RDXD, so I won't even try to pronounce it, but it's targeting CDH6. This was a study that's been presented in phase 2 and is now going to phase 3. That waterfall plot looks almost like it's 100% down. Really impressive responses. Even the patients who are slightly up are still stable disease, so really impressive response rates that we've seen here with this drug. This is coming into the market. Interestingly, even though this is targeting CDH6, they saw responses regardless of expression rate, so this may be a drug that's used in all comers. Oh, and I'm sorry for the animation coming in late, but this is the molecule itself. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to move on. Claudin-6 is something that, I'm a little biased on this one. It was developed at UCLA. It's expressed in about 60% of ovarian cancers. And this is actually a pretty impressive molecule. You can see in early studies the PFS and the OS seem to be improved over kind of historical controls or standard of care options. And so this is something that's being further developed. Right now it's in phase 2 trials, and the phase 3 trial is being developed as we speak. And this is an example of the phase 2 trial here. Here's the phase 1 efficacy results. Not only did we see nice response rates, but we saw deep responses. A lot of patients had a significant reduction in their disease. So 44% response rate, and disease control rate was even higher at 77% or in the 70s%. So I think this is something that will also come onto your radar in the near future. And then I think there are other targets, and I'm sorry for going a little over time, but WEE1 inhibitors, ATR inhibitors, CHK1/2 inhibitors, these are all things that are kind of on the horizon. And then I want to just spend a couple of seconds talking about taxanes, which have been really instrumental in ovarian cancer treatment. There was really an impressive study. This is a phase 3 trial called Rosella, looking at relacorilant and nab-paclitaxel versus chemotherapy. Relacorilant is actually targeting glucocorticoid receptor modulators, and this study doesn't really have a biomarker, but I'm going to show you the data in a second about all comers. Really impressive. And then there are other drugs as well, which I won't belabor because these are still in progress, but really exciting stuff. So the glucocorticoid receptor target here, or modulator, relacorilant, was studied, and we saw phase 2 data with promising results, and the phase 3 data just a couple weeks ago resulted and showed a PFS, and once again an OS survival. So relacorilant, oh, I'm so sensitive here. Relacorilant, in addition to nab-paclitaxel, showed a 30% reduction, or hazard ratio 0.7, in the risk of disease progression. And you can see here the median PFS was 6.5 versus 5.5, but it's really the hazard ratio that matters. And an OS of 16 months versus 11 months, or a hazard ratio of just about 0.7 again, which is similar to what we see with the mirvetuximab. So this is something that I think is really interesting. No new safety signals were seen in comparison to nab-paclitaxel, so I think this is something that, if it gets FDA approval, will become part of the landscape for these patients. And having options for these patients is really important, and this may be biomarker agnostic. ARTISTRY-7, you heard us briefly mention immunotherapy earlier. This was a study of nemvaleukin, which is an IL-2 target, and pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy. Really interesting concept based on some interesting preclinical data. Unfortunately, this was a negative study. This press release, or I actually don't even think they've had an official press release, but they have announced that their pre-specified interim analysis did not meet its endpoint. And so they are looking at subgroups to see if there are patients who would benefit from this combination, but this combination is not going to be moving further in this indication. And so I think in closing, and you know, you guys are the experts in, you know, advocating for resources. My nurses are often the ones who are like, hey, we have this data in Spanish, give it to your patient, you know? So we really rely on you. And I think pushing for institutional support, I will also just say pharmaceutical companies can also be instrumental. So using them to help get materials for your patients is really important. And research participation, until we've cured ovarian cancer, I think we need to continue to engage in opportunities to improve patients' survival and their quality of life, or toxicity management for these patients. So I want to thank you. And Emily, do you mind going through the questions? Are there any?
Sure. There's a very cool one, actually. Is folate receptor alpha found in other tissues of the body? I know not in the cornea, that I know. But is it found anywhere else?
Yeah, so I'm a little bit biased. You know, I pay most attention to gynecologic cancers, and the expression in endometrial cancer is actually also quite high. So it's not expressed in normal tissues, and I apologize, I don't know about other cancer types, but I know in endometrial cancer it's high, and there are studies ongoing in endometrial cancer as well.
And then the other question is, are you utilizing blood sampling like Guardant if another biopsy is not feasible for additional testing?
Yeah, and so the role of blood-based testing or liquid biopsies, I think, is really important. If it's looking for antibody-drug conjugates where we're looking for expression on the cancer cells, blood-based testing is going to be limited in that capacity, at least as of now. So I'll use it if I'm looking for an amplification, genetic mutation. It's helpful, but otherwise it has some limitations in that regard.